tonight on Arena. Richard Flanagan on his book Question 7. And fasten your seatbelts for a night with Bette Davis. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. This week marks the 100th anniversary of the death of one of the greatest writers in the German language, Franz Kafka. Author of Metamorphoses, The Trial and The Castle, Kafka achieved little to no fame as a writer in his lifetime. But over the past century, his nightmare world of ordinary people trapped in impenetrable bureaucratic mazes have prefigured our own modern existence, which at times we describe as Kafkaesque. During the recent International Literature Festival in Dublin, Daniel Medden, Professor of Comparative Literature at the American University of Paris, hosted an evening of readings and discussion commemorating the great writer called 100 Years of Kafka, The Life and Legacy. And while he was here, he popped into the Arena studio. Daniel, we're marking the 100th anniversary of Franz Kafka. So he was born in Prague in 1883 to a Jewish family. His father was a very overbearing man. How did his early life hone the writer he became?
Part of the great influence on his work was the world of Austria-Hungary. Kafka was born in 1883 as an Austrian citizen, and became Czech in 1918. And so that entire environment, I think, would have certainly had an influence on his sensibility, in particular the rising nationalism, which is unfortunately familiar to us now in a way that it perhaps felt far more distant 10 or 15 years ago. And so I think the kind of pressure exerted by that environment certainly had some kind of influence on his sensibility. The interesting thing is it's difficult to answer this directly because there's something in Kafka that is sui generis, that escapes it, and is not confined to the specific place in time. And that seems in his imagination, that seems nourished by his reading. I mean, he was obsessed with literature. You know, I think one of the famous lines is, "I'm made of literature." And in the same way that when you invest yourself in the stories of others, those stories become a way of seeing the world. And so I would say that what emerges from Kafka is as indebted to the experience of Dostoevsky and Knut Hamsun as to the daily circumstances that surrounded him.
And was he writing also from a very young age as well as devouring all that literature?
I mean, there's a turning point for Kafka. I think there's an interest in the arts, but he came from a family that, I mean, you know, his father was, I actually have a lot of sympathy for the father as different as the personality was. And the tricky thing with Kafka is that his reputation, all of the texts that made his fame, with some exceptions like the Metamorphoses, they were published after his death, and they were not intended for publications. These were private documents, and what happens in those kinds of documents are very different from the way you behave on a daily basis. So, and the father was really somebody who, you know, did have that kind of experience, like, I had to walk to school every day through the snow and you kids have it so easy. And he worked, I mean, he's somebody who, by force of, on the one hand, historical and cultural changes that made it possible for Jews to live in the city and to take on professions and a form of liberalization that had occurred, made it possible for him to have a child who could grow up in the middle class. On the other hand, it was absolutely vulnerable. It could have stopped at any moment. That consciousness is in his fiction too. And lots of people know it today because it's the sense of economic precarity, you know, that can disappear.
There was a breakthrough in, let's say, his earlier writing was maybe more fragmentary, and then he wrote The Judgment.
And how key was that? And why is it a key work?
Oh, that was critical. That was 1912. And that was really a turning point for several reasons. He meets this woman, Felice Bauer, who he is going to be engaged to twice in the following years. It generates 600 pages of letters. But also he begins writing like a demon, not just in fits and starts, which he had been doing previously. The Judgment in particular, he felt that this is the way that literature should be written. He began the story. He had an idea. He had a few images in his mind of what might happen. There was a picture of the Russian Revolution somewhere in the back of his head and so on. But the story went somewhere else. And it wrote itself over the course of one night. It's really funny to have the, you know, there's still the letter he wrote to work saying, I don't feel very well the following morning, because he stayed up the entire night writing the story. And I think as you read it, you can feel, you know, the excitement that must have occurred as his fantasy produced this narrative that on the one hand had so much deep material from the psyche about his father and things even beyond himself, and this ending that's utterly striking, in which the protagonist suddenly just first is condemned to death by his father and second does it, you know, he executes the sentence. And Kafka felt like he'd done something right. Something organic happened there where the work channeled him. And for the rest of his life, I mean, that was the way writing was supposed to be. And so Metamorphosis, he writes almost very shortly afterwards. And even he published it, he felt like it was okay to do. But he had regrets because a business trip interrupted the third section of the story. And he felt like he had lost some of that momentum. But it's really 1912, where before that, there are a few things that had been published. There are these things called like feuilleton texts, really impressionistic short bits in a journal. But where he comes into his own, he's had false starts at a novel about America, which he actually begins to rewrite and revise at this point after he meets Felice Bauer in 1912, and publishes the first chapter of that America novel called The Stoker. That's all done around the same time, just 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. So you said there that the writing of Metamorphosis was interrupted by a work trip.
Yes.
Because he had to work for a living.
Yes.
He worked in an insurance company, a mundane job, which also fueled his imagination. Because if we go into the trial and the castle, they're mundane. Our central characters have mundane work.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. It's the bureaucracy of Austria-Hungary. I think Robert Musil, who is also an Austrian writer, had, because it was called the Royal Imperial Empire, which is like, you know, Königliche and Kaiserliche, you know, he would abbreviate to the KK, as in Kaka, you know, Kakania. And it had this incredible, I mean, it was just so much that was bureaucratic that was also in language. And so actually Kafka's work was really fascinating because it involved, you know, if you work for a state insurance company and factories take measures to prevent accidents. You buy this equipment, which will make it less likely that somebody who's working for you will saw off his hand, you know? And of course, many of the factory owners don't want to, or they try to, you know, sidestep some of these regulations. And of course, the state wants to enforce the regulations because then it makes it cheaper to pay for the insurance. But Kafka's job was partly to go out to these factories. And I think this is a really interesting aspect. He's not an aristocratic writer. He enters these other worlds outside of his family circle as part of his work. And linguistically, yeah, the language of bureaucracy is in his fiction. He draws on it. He can be very funny with it. I think The Castle has passages that are just administrativese, you know, and it's really, really funny. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately because, you know, we know this all too well, what that kind of language is, what that means, the despair one faces when being faced with that sort of language while trying to solve a problem, a human problem.
Some people would compare these worlds he creates in The Trial and in The Castle nightmarish or otherworldly, even though it's the interaction between the central character and the worlds that causes this strangeness. Mm. Do you call his work surreal? Do you call it dreamlike? Is that why they created the word Kafkaesque? Because it's so individual.
It's absolutely fascinating. Because I'm just as fascinated, well, not just as fascinated, but, you know, as a former teacher of mine said, you fall in love with an author, then you want to know everything. And you begin by reading everything by the author and reading about the history of the author. But then, of course, if you're obsessed with literature, it's part of a larger network. And I think about the way that people have read Kafka and what they see in his work. I remember having a conversation with Yan Li, a Chinese writer who writes in English and has been writing for years. And for her, Kafka was not, yeah, I mean, this was life. This was perfectly normal. Or also Mariana Enriquez, who's a contemporary Argentinian author who writes horror. It's kind of literary horror. She's drawing on the Gothic. She's drawing on Stephen King and all of this stuff to talk about Argentinian history and other things. And it was funny. She's like, yeah, Kafka's one of these authors we were forced to read when we were in high school. And a guy who wakes up and he turns into a bug. Of course I understood that. You know, that wasn't weird to me at all. But years later, I began to understand the deeper implications of it. You know, so I think the way that you encounter, there are some people for whom any fiction that is not strictly realist is surreal, or is, you know, life itself is often what you might say of a text, unrealistic.
And do you think it's maybe a European sensibility looks at him as somebody who prefigured or foretold in his fiction what was about to come?
That's a mystery. I don't think that any writer is ever a prophet. At most, the writer is sensitive to things that are in the culture and can express them through images that are coming from the subconscious, but also driven by the things that they experience and encounter that look as though they foresee the future when read 20 years later. There's a great story about this Hungarian critic, Georg Lukács, who was Marxist and felt that fiction had to be written like Thomas Mann. You have to have a beginning and a middle and an end. And you know, and Kafka was weird. He was like, people don't wake up and turn into insects. And you know, at one point he was, I don't know if this is true or not, I love this anecdote, it has the force of truth, and he was arbitrarily arrested. This is somebody who had been a Marxist, but in communist Hungary, and thrown in this paddy wagon, and like has the revelation, ah, Kafka was a realist, you know, and I think that, no, of course he didn't see the Holocaust. That's the tragedy of retrospect, is that when you study Kafka's life and work, you see that he becomes representative for so many generations, for so many other people outside of his literary world. I mean, his three sisters die in concentration camps. You read the biography and the people that he interacted with, and everybody is affected by 20th century history. And so the reason it's memorable is because of the situations that appear in the fiction. I think that that reality was present the way that, you know, different forms of inhumanity before they find a political vehicle are already latent and in circulation.
Now, knowing the life and knowing the work, and as you said, he never expected that this work would be published in the form that he left it in when he died. What do you think was his hope? Would you think he would have honed it and changed it, or would he have destroyed it, like he asked his friend? What did he see as the purpose of writing?
I mean, I can't read his mind. I can't know at all. I do find it significant that this is the centennial of his death and not his birth, because in many ways that is the birth of Kafka the writer, the Kafka world literature, you know, because it's really after his death that his best friend gathers his work, becomes the custodian of it, and in a very intelligent and systematic way begins to edit incomplete works of fiction. Almost immediately after the death, it's 1 year later, you have the trial. The following year, you have the castle. The following year, you have America, or the man who disappeared, depending on how you want to title it in English. And then you have fragments and other texts, and gradually you have letters. And I mean, that is the Kafka that people know of in Ireland or in Egypt. I mean, this all begins after his death. He really has the amount of work that he approved of during his lifetime. It's less than 300 pages in a volume. You know, it's just a few short stories, really. I mean, it's more than just a few, but it's really just a small body of work. I think that there's no doubt ambivalence I feel this is unoriginal to repeat what Max Brod said, but I think there's a part of it that is true. On the one hand, Kafka was very, I think the temperament was one of somebody for whom it's the writing that is essential and what happens during the writing, and that it's a private activity and there's a form of spiritualism that's connected to it. But it serves its own purpose. I think of Emily Dickinson has this poem, like, I think it's publishing is the auction of the minds of man. You know, you're dirtying yourself. He was also a perfectionist. That's the other thing. Is the interesting thing is he did publish a part of the trial. It's this little parable called Before the Law, which is perfect. And he thought it was perfect. And it's part of a chapter in which people are arguing about the meaning of this parable. Joseph K. and a prison chaplain in the trial. But that page and a half, that's all he saved out of the entire manuscript because he felt like he couldn't complete it. And he was a perfectionist. And so I think it would have hurt him to know that these words were in circulation. I think also he probably knew, and he was explicit with Brod, you know, don't do anything with any of the materials that hasn't been published already. Brod also recognized his genius, and Kafka knew that. Kafka absolutely knew that. So I think it's like many human beings. It's complicated. It's difficult to say it was this or it was that. It was probably some combination of things. And the thing that was sad in 1924 was that he died so horribly and so prematurely. And that's partly because of the First World War, where he was healing from tuberculosis and got the Spanish flu in the dying, you know, days of the First World War and never recovered ultimately.
So Daniel, your talk and the discussion you chaired was the life and legacy. You've touched on the legacy, the profound effect he's had on so many writers. Mm. But it goes beyond writing, doesn't it? It's all in our popular culture, in films, in people's imagination as they write and create art.
Mm. I think the thing that interests me most is the way that writing travels in the imagination and influence as a sort of not something that is subservient to, but is somehow, I don't know, it's a form of inspiration that this way is possible. And maybe you don't know that before until you read a certain author and you see that approach. There's a great example of that is Gabriel Garcia Marquez reads The Metamorphosis, and he has this kind of like, oh my God, I didn't know you were allowed to write like this. This is the way that my grandmother tells stories. You know? And so I'm fascinated by the interesting fiction that is Kafka-inflected, in no ways indebted, but inflected from the Middle East, from Latin America, from Asia. There's a marvelous experimental Chinese writer, Chan Shui, who is, I mean, and you could feel it. And to me, it's, again, it's not, the debt is not to Kafka, I think it's to literature. And that's already present in Kafka's work, is this is soaked in his own readings and the real delight of discovery and what happens when somebody else's imagination carries you away.
That was Daniel Medin on Franz Kafka on the 100th anniversary of Kafka's death. Richard Flanagan's Booker Prize-winning novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, told the story of the Australian prisoners of war who worked on the Death Railroad in Burma during World War II. That book was in part inspired by his father's experience of being slave labour for the Japanese army in that war. Question 7, Flanagan's new non-fiction book, goes back to his father's experience in Japan and counterpoints it with the race in Nazi Germany and among the Allies to develop a bomb so powerful and devastating that it would end the war. Question 7 explores the power of language through a set of chain reactions, a literary love affair between H.G. Wells and Rebecca West, a nuclear physicist inspired by one of Wells' novels, and Richard's own near-death experience on the Franklin River in his native Tasmania. And I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Flanagan.
Richard, fans of your Booker winning The Narrow Road to the Deep North will not be unfamiliar with references in question 7 to the Japanese prisoner of war camps. But this is a book of non-fiction, while The Narrow Road to the Deep North was fiction. It's really ostensibly a memoir, but it's very unconventional. Did you set out for it to be a memoir, or did you have bigger questions and bigger fish to fry?
Look, I think I was, maybe I was Ishmael, and I ended up looking for a white whale. It's a book about the choices, really, we make about love and life and the consequences of those decisions. And it's also about how we cannot be what we cannot dream, and we actually live in the dreams of others. And it's how a book begat a world, which in turn begat another book, and which leads me here today to be talking to you. And it really begins, I guess, with a kiss in an Edwardian drawing room, and by over a century ago, and leads by a circuitous route to my childhood in a very remote mining town in a vast ancient rainforest on the west coast of Tasmania. And I guess it's a sort of love letter to both my island home and my now my long dead parents.
Yes, and it does all that. Let's get the title of the book, Question 7, out of the way first. Where does it come from, and what does it mean?
Well, it comes from a very early Chekhov story written by the great Russian master when he was starting out writing humorous sketches. And it was a parody of those sort of mental arithmetic questions asked of school children. And what he did in this little sketch was turn them on their heads with a non sequitur. So Chekhov's original question 7 goes like this: Wednesday, June the 7th, a train had to leave station A at 3 a.m. in order to reach station B at 11 p.m. Just as the train is about to depart, however, an order comes that it must arrive at station B by 7 p.m. Who loves longer, a man or a woman? And it's just a joke, but in a sense it's a joke that cuts to the heart of the matter, which is, why do we do what we do to each other? Who does love longer? How to live? What is it to live? The way in which we think we live in a world of timetables and numbers, and that is our reality. And in that very early sketch, you get all the greatness of Chekhov's later stories, which begin ostensibly in the reality of a dinner party or a doctor visiting someone, and then suddenly you fall through this void into this other world, which seems less real, but is actually the true world that matters to us, that pulses thick and hard through our wrist. And that's the world of what it is to live and how to live. And I guess the book is really written trying to understand how in an indifferent universe people who are too easily dismissed as everyday find meaning and make an answer to the horror of this world. And I thought more and more about my parents and how they did it through their acts of kindness and goodness and their stories and jokes, and asserting an idea of love. And they practiced that love and defended that love and lived that love. And when I was younger, I thought it was an illusion. But over time, they turned that illusion into a truth and that truth into a reality. And I guess it was a form of magic, and they, the magicians. And I thought, again, when I was younger, that they were naive to think their love might make a difference. But when I was writing this book, I realised the naivety was mine alone.
Yes, because they had such hard lives, and in your father's case, this tragic life of having worked as a slave in the Japanese prisoner of war camps, that when they came back and were together and had a family, I presume that they could see priorities that maybe a young boy couldn't see, or a love that the importance of love from what they had come from.
I think what they saw was that certain things mattered and most things didn't, and that material things and a world of ambition, of possessions, that these things weren't important. And what ultimately mattered was your capacity for kindness and goodness. I think we live in a world now where, you know, there's so much despair now, and it is because we're encouraged to take our compass from power. And, you know, power is always with us, but its wages are horror. And if we only look at power, we will live in despair. Whereas if we look at the reality of our lives, at our friends and our family, complex and difficult as it often and mostly is, it's also a source of endless hope because there is goodness and kindness to be found there. Now, and I guess that's what I saw in my parents' lives.
Yes, and it is your parents' lives in the book that provide that sense of hope. But to go back to what you were talking about, this love affair, this meeting in an Edwardian room between H.G. Wells and Rebecca West, and a book by H.G. Wells having a huge effect on a physicist who was engaged in looking for the secret of how to create this bomb that would end all wars. Tell us about Leo Szilard and H.G. Wells and how they're connected.
Well, what happens is that Wells meets, Wells, a middle-aged man, meets a young Rebecca West, then 18, in his drawing room in London in 1911. And they quickly begin a passionate affair, and they kiss in front of his bookcase. And Wells, who was famously a proponent of free love, ran away in terror. And he was terrified because she just didn't want sex. She wanted the whole package. And Wells fled he had a complex love life. He fled to his mistress's chalet in Switzerland, where he wrote a book which envisaged a weapon of complete and mass destruction. And that weapon was founded in the latest science, the discoveries about radium. But Wells foresaw so much more than the scientists, and he was trained in science, and he could see the possibilities implicit in the science, and he invented this weapon called an atomic bomb. The book he wrote wasn't very good, and it was a book that he wrote in flight from love, and he invented in his rejection of that love an idea of mass destruction. And 20 years later, a young Jewish refugee physicist who had fled Hitler's Germany read this book, and crossing the traffic lights at Southampton Row in London, just near the British Museum, the book inspired him to have a vision of a nuclear chain reaction, which at that point no one had ever conceived. And that was the great theoretical breakthrough that enabled the building of the atomic bomb. And Szilard also saw, because he was a scientist of brilliance, but also one with a moral imagination and a political imagination. And he recognised that the likely country to first invent a bomb would be Germany, and that if Hitler got the bomb, he would enslave the world. And so in the late 30s, he enlists Einstein to petition Roosevelt to begin an atomic bomb program to forestall the Nazis getting the bomb. And that leads to the Manhattan Project, that leads to the bomb dropping on Hiroshima and then on Nagasaki, the hundreds of thousands of dead. And in consequence, ironically, and this is one of the great ironies of my life, my father, who was near death and who would have died if the war dragged on for a few months more, as it was going to without the bomb, my father, who was a prisoner 80 miles south of Hiroshima, he lived, and all those innocent people died in that great crime. And because of that bomb, because of the novel that H.G. Wells wrote, I'm here talking to you today. And so, you know, it's often said, quoting Auden, that poetry makes nothing happen. But it is also the case that a novel destroyed Hiroshima. And so I think the book is about how we so often live in other stories of which we're unknowing about, and we need to think more carefully about the stories we tell and try and tell better stories in the hope that we might live better.
Yes, because though H.G. Wells was not a scientist, what he said in the book inspired this physicist to get that hunch, and the hunch was the idea that led to the chain reaction, which led to the notion of what created the Manhattan Project.
That's right.
And obviously H.G. Wells had no idea that he had that connection with the bomb, did he?
He was aware that he'd predicted it. He wasn't aware of the connection with Szilard, although he'd actually met Szilard prior to this. But Szilard makes it very clear in his writings at the time and subsequently of his debt to Wells's novel, and that it is Wells's vision that haunts him, and it's Wells's vision that inspires him to come up with this vision and then the theory of the nuclear chain reaction.
The other very interesting part of your book is that your family are from Tasmania, and that you go back into the history of Tasmania, first of all the colonisation and really the genocide of the Aboriginal people there. And then there's a lot about the convicts, which of course would be very pertinent for Irish readers and listeners, the convict island that was Van Diemen's land back then. And you talk a lot about how the convicts were dealt with or were considered by the other people who lived on the island.
Tasmania, or Van Diemen's Land as it was known, was the gulag of the British Empire. But more than that, the system there was modelled on the Caribbean plantation slave system. And it was a totalitarian slave society. And my forebears were all Irish people sent out during the famine for various crimes, sometimes stealing food, sometimes political crimes. But this was a huge trauma to be part of a slave system, because you were not only the slave, but you were the enslaver. You know, that there were convict flagellators, convict hangmen, convict constables, convict clerks. And this trauma, which is a quarter of the island's modern history, remained deeply buried in the psyche of the Tasmanian people. And Tasmania has remained to this day the poorest and most backward of all the Australian states. It's remote from Australia, 400 kilometres away. And it has a second trauma that it has to deal with, which is the near successful genocide of the Tasmanian Aboriginal people, a war of extermination, as it was called at the time, that was waged with a great and pitiless brutality by the British authorities. And after those two traumas, most of the people in Tasmania to this day are descendants of either the convicts or the Aborigines or a mix of both. And there is a haunting of the island in consequence, and there is much that has never been named or said which needs to be named or said. And I wanted to try and understand myself, to ask questions of myself about what that means for the way I might write and conceive of my world. And I try and address some of that in the book.
Yes.
Because I guess, you know, if you're listening to this in Kerry or Sligo or Dublin or wherever, you may think that Tasmanians are Western people like the Irish, that we are similar. But the reality is, we were changed by these experiences. We became different. There is an idea of colonisation that it destroys everything. It does destroy much, but equally in my island, there was a reverse river that ran through it, and that was that people took on many of the values, the ways of thinking, the mentality of the Indigenous people, and there was this reverse river of indigenisation and ideas of time, of space, of clan, family, of the relationship to the land, which were Indigenous, took hold amongst the ex-convicts, and it didn't make them Indigenous, but it made them different. But people never named what that difference was, and I think sometimes it falls to others to try and find the words for these differences, and that was one of the tasks I felt I had in writing this book, to try and understand something of that difference.
Another event that you endeavour to come to terms with here is what happened to you on the Franklin River when you were just 21. It is so wonderfully written. It is like the most dramatic cliffhanger of a piece of writing anybody will ever read. So I don't want to go into the event as such, because I'm sure it is a very painful event to recall and have written. But what made you feel that it was this book that you should? I know you made attempts before to write about it in books, but that you did it so vividly and comprehensively in this book.
Because one of the ideas, because the book is about, as I was saying at the beginning, about, I think during that long dark night of COVID, people became more and more concerned with the question of what is it to live, how to live. And you see that in the wake of COVID and everything from the so-called Great Resignation in the West to the Lie Flat movement in China, people trying to assert some better idea of what life might be, to find some more meaning in their life. And I thought about how when my father survived the horrors of those prisoner of war camps and returned, he told me how he travelled around the island, going to its beaches and forests and rivers, and sitting in the small pinched kitchens of his family, drinking tea from the cracked teapots, and feeling within all those things the immense love of others, and that sense that this what it was to live, that this love was what life was. And when I had this experience that I describe in the book, after it, I felt that I had the most extraordinary sensations that I was of the earth and belonged to it. And these sensations never really left me. And I wanted to touch the earth and to be with people, because I realised that whatever meaning there is in this world, it doesn't exist in yourself, it exists in others. And ever after that, I never really cared much about ambition, material things. I simply cared about being with others, and it's that where I find my meaning. And so I found, I guess when I thought about it, I saw in my father's experience my own, and in my own, my father's. And I guess the book is a mirroring of the two.
Yes, that these near-death experiences, or in your case, a death experience, that you see what's important, or this to be near to the earth, to be near to people.
Well, yes.
Thank you so much. Richard Flanagan's new book is Question 7, and it's out now, and it's published by Chatto and Windus.
Lips sweet surprise.
The Irish Film Institute is delighted to announce a special series of screenings to celebrate a true Hollywood icon, Bette Davis, of course, one of the greatest actors in film history. Known for her distinctive voice, intensity, and of course those Bette Davis eyes. She often portrays complex and independent women and won not one but two Academy Awards over her impressively long-spanning six-decade career. I'm joined now in studio by Paul Whittington to discuss the career of Bette Davis and her many films. For such an impressive career, it didn't start out so well.
No, it didn't. She was born in Lowell, Massachusetts, and she was very kind of, you know, Brahmin Yankee, a bit like, you know, Katharine Hepburn. Like, she had that kind of arch kind of demeanor and posh sound. She wanted to dance when she was young, to the horror of her parents, especially her father, and then she became interested in acting. She tried to make it on the stage in New York. She couldn't do that. And then she went to Hollywood in 1932 to audition for Universal, and the guy, the flunky sent to the station, the Union Station, to get her, went back because he said there was nobody there who looked like an actress. So, and she was not conventionally kind of, you know, beautiful, considered to be. And so she had a rocky start. She didn't really do well at Universal. They were about to let her go when somebody noticed her eyes, and the which seemed at times to operate independently of any screenplay. Like, you know, even when she was in a later, when she became famous for playing villains, she was always doing different things and giving them depth and making them not one dimensional. She would have been a brilliant silent actress, actually. She arrived just too late for that. But her potential was eventually noticed at first Universal and then really at MGM.
Yes.
At Warner's, rather.
And they did love doing those close-ups on those eyes, didn't they?
They did. And I think that there's loads of examples of films that she did where she makes you wonder what her character is thinking, even as you're supposed to, you know, to hate a character. Like in Jezebel, she plays this, you know, which we'll get to, she plays this absolute banana who is just so willful and spoilt and will do anything to get her way. And yet you wonder what's going on, and she's hurt by something, you don't know what. So she had that incredible quality.
So it was Warner Brothers, really, that gave her big start.
Yes, they did. Really, it was... George Arliss, an English actor, saved her career because he asked her to play the female lead in a Warner Brothers film called The Man Who Played God, because he thought she had something. After that, she was cast in Human Bondage as another harpy, basically. This was where she was originally in melodramas, and then they realised, you know, there was something else going on. At that point in Hollywood, actors like her great rival in years to come, Joan Crawford, didn't want to play nasty people. They wanted to play heroines. But Bette Davis wasn't like that at all. She wanted to play meaty roles, and the meatiest were baddies. And in Of Human Bondage, for which she should have won an Oscar and didn't, actually, she played this Mildred Rogers, this tea room waitress, who was incredibly sort of callous and cruel, and you know, she does all sorts of things, and she, you know,
against lovely Leslie Howard.
Yeah, poor old lovely Leslie Howard, who was lovely in real life as well. And so she gets mixed up in his life. She eventually gets her comeuppance, because that was how it worked. But she turned the death scene. She had people crying when she was dying, even though she was despicable. So that's how good she was at this.
So you said she should have really won an Academy Award for that role. But then shortly afterwards, she did win one for Dangerous. I don't know this film at all.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. We were saying outside how unfortunately they never show these films on television anymore, which is a pity. So younger people don't get a chance to see them. But it's kind of more of a conventional melodrama. I mean, she plays this woman called Joyce, who's a kind of a former Broadway star, has a downer look. She gets her hooked into this kind of architect and starts messing with his life. But what they used to do, they used to ruin these roles at the end of them by making them have, you know, last minute Pauline conversions. And she decides to do the right thing and let him go back to his more appropriate fiancé at the end. She was good in it. She was better in the other, but she won her first Oscar for this.
So then we go on to films like The Letter and now Voyager, which are films that we think of, oh yeah, that's Bette Davis.
Absolutely. She had a golden period through the late 30s, early 1940s, when she was the highest paid star in Hollywood, but not before she had a big falling out with Warner's, because a bit like Katharine Hepburn, who was slightly younger than her, She once she got her break in of human bondage, and thereafter she decided, like, she wanted to run her own career. This script isn't good for me. This is going to ruin my career. And of course, that wasn't the way it worked. And she had a big spat with Warners when she wouldn't do what they wanted and they wouldn't do what she wanted. She fled to London. There was a court case. She went to the version at that point of the British tabloids to say how she was a wage slave. She lost the court case. But she made her point, and her moxie was duly noted, if you like, and thereafter they kind of tried to string her along as she became the star of these incredible this incredible string of films.
Now, Now Voyager is a, yeah. Can you set up the scene? Because there are so many well-known lines from it. There's her smoking the two cigarettes and giving
Paul Heinrich, highly suggestive stuff, yes, at the time. Yes. This was a different kind of challenge for her because she played this very put upon. We are asked to believe that she was sort of a sort of frumpy, you know, young woman with glasses, started oppressed by her dreadful mother. And then she slims down and she becomes this, she starts to realise herself and take control of her own life. And it's again, there's a lot to do. There's a big arc for her in this performance.
Yes, and I think in the end she decides, she meets and falls in love with Paul Heinrich's character, but she decides she's going to look after his daughter, but they can never be together or something
super
like
noble
that.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
So let's play here now Voyager.
May I sometimes come here?
Whenever you like. It's your home too. There are people here who love you.
They look at you and Tina, share with you peace and contentment.
Of course. And just think it won't be for this time only. That is, if you will help me keep what we have. If we both try hard to protect that little strip of territory that's ours. We can talk about your child.
Our child.
Thank you.
And will you be happy, Charlotte?
Oh, Jerry, don't let us ask for the moon. We have the stars.
What a killer line.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She can deliver it,
they
too.
They were really laying it on thick there. She could do that stuff, but she was better playing the tough nuts. And there's a reason for that, of course, because she wasn't herself, but she was better playing.
So let's get on to the... Well, tough nuts are... Jezebel is... She's a crazy nut.
Yeah, no, I think in Jezebel, her character's interesting because she, you know, in that film, which again used to be shown on TCM all the time, it isn't anymore, she...
This is kind of Civil War stuff, is
it's,
it?
It's antebellum, Civil just War, before yes. the Civil War, and it's in New Orleans, and she's this kind of spoilt and willful sort of society heiress, and because her boyfriend doesn't pay attention when she's getting her dress fitting for the ball, she decides to get her own back by turning up in a scandalous red gown, which of course you can't see that it's red. You have to believe that because it's black and white. And thereafter it all starts to go horribly wrong for her. So she's kind of the architect of her own downfall, really.
Okay, so Julie Marsden is her character, Bette Davis, and she shows Preston Dillard, who's played by Henry Fonda, her red dress.
Would you like to see my new dress?
That's what I wanted to do all day.
Well, let me go then. There it is.
For the Olympus ball?
Isn't it lovely?
Julie, it's red.
It's gorgeously red.
You can't wear red to the Olympus ball.
Why not?
You never saw an unmarried girl in anything but white.
Well, you're going to see one tomorrow night.
Julie, you can't be serious.
Oh, are you afraid somebody will take me for one of those girls from Gallatin Street?
Julie!
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot I'm a child. I'm not supposed to know about things like Gallatin Street. I'm just supposed to flutter around in white.
You're supposed to know better than to scandalize the whole town.
It might be bad for the bank. Of course. Will you please hold another director's meeting and ask him to decide what I can wear?
Julie, for heaven's sake, will you be reasonable?
Well, are you reasonable this afternoon?
So that's it. You're just nursing a spite. Well, I'm not going to let you. You've made your point for once. You're going to do as I say. I'm calling for you tomorrow night at 10, and you're going to be dressed properly for the ball in white.
Am I? Oh, but of course, Preston, if you say so.
Don't be absurd. Your own good sense will say so.
And if it doesn't?
Then, my sweet, you and I will sit at home quietly with our embroidery.
She's so cheeky. She's so vivacious. You've
bold. Reminded me in some other clip. You're kind of up for her in it. You know, she's just not having any of it, and she's just terrific in it. You know?
Yes, yeah, and the way she moves. I remember she was in The Crinoline, and she had all those little tight ringlets, but she could
and
still
her, and
have
her foghorn leghorn country accent as well, which she really went for. But she went for everything. She was totally committed, fearless kind of actor like that.
And she did win the Oscar for this.
Yeah. And I think she's had something like seven nominations. She was the Meryl Streep of her time. She's about seven nominations throughout the she was just nominated every second year, basically.
So we're moving on now to All About Eve.
Yeah.
Do you think this character, Margot Channing, that she plays, we think that's Bette Davis. I don't know, Bette Davis. Do you think she's...
I think possibly so, because she's kind of sharp, but she's not unkind. And she's kind of... And she takes this younger actress under her wing. And I wondered, who was sitting outside this, wondered watching it again, did she sort of know that it was going to blow up? Was she sick of being this big Broadway star, and did she want someone to knock her off her perch because she seems sort of so philosophical. It's a beautifully written film, and she's tremendous, and this real knowing kind of older person who knows that the younger actress, duplicitous as she is going to have to one day be in her position.
Yes, it's a great film. Let's listen to this. We have Celeste Holm, who's her friend Karen, her husband Hugh Marlowe, and producer Max, played by Gregory Ratoff, stand back as the actress hostess, played by Bette Davis, Margot Channing, delivers her famous line in All About Eve.
The kid, Junior that is, will be down in a minute, unless you'd like to take her drink up to her.
I can get a fresh one. Karen, you're a Gibson girl. The general atmosphere is very Macbethish. What has or is about to happen?
What is he talking about?
Macbeth.
We know you. We've seen you like this before. Is it over or is it just beginning? Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night. Please.
Again, a great delivery of a great line.
Yes, yeah, no, it's a wonderful. I think George Sanders in that film as well, but it's a lovely film, and it stands the test of time really well. Some of the earlier melodramas don't, because they're made nearly 100 years ago, but that is such a beautifully written film. But and in that film, of course, she's playing an actress who's about to turn 40 and worried that her career is going to go off a cliff. And in fact, that's exactly what happened to Bette Davis shortly after this.
Yes, because some people might know her and her story from Feud,
yes,
which was the series about the making of whatever happened to Baby
kind
Jane.
Kind of cartoonish view of the whole thing, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
and it was herself and Joan Crawford, but they did vie with each other. I mean, they were not best friends.
They certainly were not. There's a wonderful quote, actually, when Joan Crawford died. I think Bette Davis used to do the chat show circuit. She said, you should never say bad things about the dead. You should only say good. Joan Crawford is dead. Good. So they were both like that with each other, and I think the feud may have been started by studios, but they went for it together. And in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which used to be shown again all the time in television, it's this real strange guignol horror, and they play a former child actress and her sister, and they live in a house together, and Bette Davis is just horrible to Joan Crawford. So she must have found
that
quite
satisfying.
I mean,
so horrible. It involves rats. And
it does. Rats presented under a dinner plate. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, has to be seen. So anybody going to the IFI is going to have a great time.
Once seen, never forgotten, that film.
So Paul Whittington, thank you so much. That was talking about the life and career of Bette Davis, who the IFI is celebrating with a season of 10 of her iconic films this June. For more information, you can go to ifi.ie. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Barbara Rose Sanwo. James Feeney was on sound. Ali Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next after the news at 8.